Well, he brought us one of the most incredible works I've ever read about the subject of Egypt, the Giza power plant. And now Christopher Dunn has done it again with Lost Technologies of Ancient Egypt. And when we are back, we are going to talk with him full program tonight about this. It's truly an incredible story. Christopher Dunn next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Christopher Dunn has worked at every level of high-tech manufacturing. That includes being a machinist, toolmaker, programmer, operator of high-power industrial lasers, project engineer, laser operations manager. And Chris's Pyramid Odyssey began in 1977 after he read Peter Tompkins' book, Secrets of the Great Pyramid. And his reaction immediately after learning of the Great Pyramid's precision and design characteristics was to consider that this edifice may have had an original purpose that was a little different from conventional opinion. Discovering the purpose of this machine and documenting his case has taken the better part of 20 years of research, and here he is back on Coast to Coast AM. Christopher, how are you?
I'm fine, George. How are you?
Good.
Nice to talk to you again.
It's been so long, we could have built another pyramid by the time you came back. It's good to have you back.
It's good to talk to you, too.
You know, I'm in St. Louis. I'm not too far from where you are right about now.
Well, we're going to have dinner sometime.
Absolutely. I'm here for about three more weeks, and then it's heading back for Los Angeles. And by the way, you've done it again with this book, Lost Technologies of Ancient Egypt.
Thank you.
Just another home run, Chris, and just great job.
Great thank job. You very much.
For a lot of new listeners who are just joining the program, who are relatively new since you were last on with me more than 3 years ago, let's go back a little bit. Before we go forward, and tell us about the Giza power plant and your theories about that. That'll put a lot of this in perspective, I think, for everyone.
Oh, sure. Well, the Giza power plant actually had its genesis in 1977 when I was reading Peter Tompkins' book, Secret of the Great Pyramid. And essentially, the information brought forward in that book was from a variety of people who questioned whether the Great Pyramid was actually originally a tomb. And they suggested other purposes for it, such as a astronomical observatory, a granary, other features, a geodetic marker, a temple, but different purposes than actually a tomb. When I looked at it, though, and this was my first experience of actually looking at the schematics of the inside of the Great Pyramid, the very, very unusual shafts and chambers and little passageways, that it seemed to me that it really didn't make sense. And so the tomb theory really didn't make sense. So I examined it further and tried to make sense of what I thought was the schematics of a machine. And one of the critical parts of the research of this particular machine that is key to understanding it is its precision. And of course, having worked with precision all my life and manufacturing precision, I'm finding information about an ancient edifice, a structure that was built thousands of years ago that had the precision of a machine, except on a scale of acres, really made me sit up and pay attention. And so that I then began to, of course, formulate the idea that perhaps if the ancient Egyptians were to put such a tremendous amount of resources into building this structure. And examining the structure in detail, you see that it's a highly sophisticated assembly of limestone and granite, precisely crafted within thousands of an inch in some cases, that the engineers and the construction people, the craftspeople who cut the stone and put it together, were highly intelligent and were highly skilled. And so a civilization that exists that is so talented and so knowledgeable, would they actually support the building of such a structure when it's only to house a single body? It just didn't make sense. So if it was not a tomb, then mm-hmm. what is it? And the thought that I had was, well, obviously the people who built it, they wanted something out of it. And normally our largest structures today that we build are power generating facilities. And I thought, well, maybe it was a power plant. And based on that premise, I began to examine it in greater detail. And over many, many years, talking to different people, physicists, engineers, electronics technicians and engineers, and chemical engineers, I finally formulated the theory, which is in the Giza power plant, that the Great Pyramid actually functioned as a holistic power plant device, mm-hmm. drawing energy from the Earth and converting it to electromagnetic energy in the form of microwaves that exited the southern shaft of the King's Chamber.
Was it the shape, Christopher, of the pyramid that gave it that its ability to do that?
I think the shape is very important. It serves to be an acoustical horn or antenna, and in fact, it's a coupled oscillator to the Earth. It's also seismically very stable. That shape is very stable in that any vibration of the structure, if the walls were vertical, they would tend to be less stable than the inclined walls of a pyramid. So I think this shape and also whether the actual shape of the Great Pyramid and its unusual angle, which is 51 degrees, 51 minutes, 14 seconds, is actually the angle that you would have in a pyramid shape or structure that would encoded the function of pi, which is 3.1415926.
Amazing.
Whereas the perimeter of the Great Pyramid has the same relationship to its height as the radius has to the circumference of a circle. So that the pi factor is definitely in the Great Pyramid.
Christopher, are you a believer that the pyramids of Giza were constructed 5,000 years ago, 10,000 years ago, maybe even farther back?
I'm inclined to believe that the pyramids and temples in Egypt were built earlier. It's not fundamental or crucial to my work to have them placed in any particular epoch or any century. They could have been constructed 2,000 years ago. The evidence is doesn't change. It just gets older. But the evidence is still the same. And so as far as who built it, I really don't have any strong opinion. What I would say, though, is that because of the genius and the manufacturing capabilities of the builders of the Great Pyramid and also the temples and statues in Egypt, because of their capabilities and the clear evidence that they were using mechanical precise machines, or that they were crafting with mechanical precision and must mm-hmm. have had machinery, because their evidence actually proves that, as outlined in Lost Technologies of Ancient Egypt, that because the machines don't exist, we have to ask the question, well, what happened to them?
If
they do exist, they haven't been found. And so if they can't be found because they're not on the planet or they have eroded away over time, then the further back we go, the more reasonable it seems that we can say that even very large pieces of equipment that would not be stripped down and used for other purposes by surviving civilization would erode over time.
That's true.
If they're made out of ferrous materials, like we make our machines out of ferrous materials. So there is that part of it, too.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead. No, sir.
If an architect today wanted to design the pyramids, what kind of, not for construction purposes, but for architectural purposes, what would he use today? I assume computers, computer graphics, he'd have his calculators with him. He'd have all these instruments to just, outline and plot how this thing is going to be constructed. In ancient Egypt, and we'll get into the lost technologies and the equipment, but I'm sure they had to have had architectural wonders there who plotted this stuff out, right?
Oh, yes. I mean, yes, they were very capable. And one of the... One of the problems that we have, though, and which I try to avoid in writing the Lost Technologies of Ancient Egypt, is that we can discuss what we have available today, but I think what we have to do is study the artifacts and the results of their work and just determine exactly what are the minimum requirements that they would need. How far back in our history would we need to go to say, okay, at this point in our manufacturing history, we had the capabilities to create these objects, and we had the technology and they had the knowledge of the geometry and precision to be able to create these. Now, if we go back even 40, 50 years, and we go back to the time of the slide rules in every engineer's pockets. The engineers of that day were very capable of designing a pyramid that looks or would look exactly like the Great Pyramid in terms of the number of blocks, the shape of the blocks, the position of the blocks. The only difficulty is, when you talk to construction engineers, is actually putting the thing together, and right. Then in a reasonable amount of time, because the quotation from a modern quarry expert said that it would take 27 years just to quarry the stone to build the Great Pyramid without even putting it together. And there are some construction engineers that say that it's beyond our capabilities. I would rely on a construction engineer's opinion. But there are a lot of theorists who believe it's entirely possible.
Well, you listen to Zahi Hawass, you had 100,000 people running around pulling these things and chopping away at them, and I just can't see that.
I can't either. The problem with the simplistic viewpoint, the problem with simple solutions is when they go to demonstrate those simple solutions, the efforts are simple and primitive. So in the shadow of the Great Pyramid that has 70-ton blocks of granite, you'll see demonstrations on documentaries where there are guys in these little diapers or whatever they call them, hauling half-ton blocks up to the Giza Plateau, and they say, well, that's the way they did it because they didn't have the machinery, they didn't have the wheel back then, and that we have some tomb drawings that actually show hundreds of Egyptians pulling on ropes on large statues, so they had to have used those methods. But when you start to look in detail at what is required just to cut the stone with the precision and to be able to do it efficiently, the methods that are described by Egyptologists really do not explain the evidence on the ground. So it really needs a team of experts in different disciplines to fully understand and describe what is necessary to build a Great Pyramid. A lot of people have tried, and a lot of a lot of theories work things out well on paper. And having worked in the real world, I know that whatever you describe on paper does not necessarily transfer into the workplace. So it is a huge problem.
Christopher, can you outline for us the possibilities of who may have constructed these? And I know that's not part of your theory of lost technologies of ancient Egypt, but I'm sure you've probably have wrestled with this yourself. But, you know, I would have thought ancient Egyptians, another civilization, extraterrestrials. I mean, have you, how many are out there possible?
Well, I've considered all of them. I've read pretty much all of them. I think that there is a problem when we try to, a political problem when we try to strip the credit from the Egyptians and assign it to another culture, and that seems to be rather a chauvinistic stance, where we say, well, the Egyptians weren't capable of doing this, so it must have been another civilization. And right. They're very, very skittish about people who will try to put the credit to Atlanteans or aliens, and even they don't like. It seems to me they don't like to, or at least the official Egyptologists in Egypt don't like to accept the notion that the ancient Egyptians used modern equipment, or that they were a highly advanced civilization.
That's a good point, and I wonder why, because even taking the possibility then, the large possibility that Egyptians constructed these with incredible technology, which we'll get into, why would they kind of want to disassociate themselves from that?
I will say that there are many Egyptians who welcome this kind of credit to their civilization. And certainly, Lost Technologies of Ancient Egypt, I give the ancient Egyptians credit, and actually I dedicate the book to the Egyptians and their glorious heritage. So it's recognition for what they actually did by describing their work and putting credit where credit's due, which means that the conventional view on how the ancient Egyptians built the pyramids and temples and statues has to be revised. And I think where the political roadblocks are there is in the educational system, and they're kind of vested in this the Western view of history, which does not include a highly advanced ancient Egypt. It, you know, they don't consider the Egyptians more advanced than the Romans or the Greeks. So, and the Egyptian Egyptologists are trained in the West. For instance, Dr. Zahi Hawass, he got his degree from the University of Pennsylvania.
Yeah, that's right.
So he was trained by Western Egyptologists in his
thinking
profession.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And there's a lot of money involved in it too.
Oh, absolutely. And is it conceivable that this technology was not just in Egypt at that time, but might have been all over the planet at that time?
Conceivable, I think, is actual. It's not just conceivable.
See, I kind of tippy-toe, Chris.
Yeah, I know you did. It's not like we have to ask the question because we don't know. We know it's all over the planet. All you have to do is travel to South America, and you can see it. A Pumapunku, I mean, that's another incredible site that shows evidence of advanced technology.
Hey, Christopher, we're going to take this break. We're going to come back and get into Lost Technologies of Ancient Egypt next on Coast to Coast AM. If you are not a member yet of Streamlink Coast Insiders, well, you can be for just pennies a day. take care of your past archives and your downloads and your podcasting and your iPhone apps. And again, I've been getting emails. When are you going to get the Android apps? How about the Blackberries? They're working on that. I was told several weeks ago it was around 2 months to go, so it's getting close. And when I get back to L.A., I'll get a more pinpointed date for you on that as well. When we come back, more with Christopher Dunn as we talk about his incredible work, Lost Technologies of Ancient Egypt, on Coast to Coast AM. Christopher, tell us about the evolution of Lost Technologies of Ancient Egypt. How did this happen for you?
Well, the evolution of Lost Technologies, really, I would go back to the 1986. I was at the Open Air Museum at Memphis, which is a few miles south of Cairo.
Mm-hmm.
And it struck me as odd that as I was looking down the length of the Ramses statue, the left and right nostrils on the statue, on the nose, were identical mirror images to each other. And it's always been my understanding, and certainly true in my case, that no adult has identical nostrils. So this was significant to me at the time, and it stayed with me for quite a while. Now, after the Giza Power, of course, at that time in 1986, I was doing studies of the Great Pyramid. I was more interested in the engineering of the pyramids than I was on statues or temples, and
right.
I really didn't travel south to the temples at Luxor, Dendera, and other places in the southern Egypt. But I stayed around Giza and was studying the Great Pyramid and other pyramids. But that kind of stayed with me. Then, after the Giza power plant was published, I entered into quite a few discussions about the theory of the Giza power plant and also some of the other information that I brought out in the book, particularly the crafting of hard igneous rock like granite and diorite. And I brought into the book a chapter that was entitled Advanced Machining in Ancient Egypt. There was discussion, there was debate. Some people disagreed with my conclusions. Other people thought they were interesting and felt that further research needed to be done. But there were some people that actually thought that I'd gone too far with the Giza power plant theory, and that the evidence of advanced machining or craftsmanship in ancient Egypt was more powerful a subject, because the theory really could not be proven false or proven to be correct unless you actually build another pyramid.
Right.
And demonstrate it. So the theory is just that. It's a theory. But the capabilities of the ancient Egyptians to craft hard igneous rock to a high order of precision and geometry, that is something that is factual, and it is very, very strong and powerful evidence. So that really weighed into my decision to write a book about simply the craftsmanship of the ancient Egyptians and the tools that they would have used.
Were you in awe with the craftsmanship?
Oh, George, let me tell you. A visit by an engineer, and I've known many engineers that have traveled to Egypt and gone to and walked around the pyramids. I've taken engineers to Egypt and had discussions with them at the pyramids in the north, at the temples in the south, and further south at the unfinished obelisk. And it's always the engineers that end up with a certain amount of humility and awe about what the ancient Egyptians were able to accomplish. You walk through the temple at Luxor, and you walk in between two giant statues about 45 feet tall, weighing 600 tons, perfectly crafted, and solid pieces of granite. And then over near the on the west bank, you have the the Ramses statues, the colossi of Mammon, and they are absolutely huge, about 1,000 tons weight each. And you see the way that they are cut and the order of precision with which they are cut. It is awe-inspiring. I'm always awed by it, as many other people are.
Go ahead. No, I want you to finish.
Well, because I always look at it from the point of view. Well, how would I create something today? And really, that is the cornerstone of Lost Technologies of Ancient Egypt, and that is to throw the challenge out to whoever wishes to pick up the challenge, to throw the challenge out that, you know, we as lay people, we're not Egyptologists, I'm not an Egyptologist, have watched so many documentaries by different presenters, with Egyptologists being involved and also other disciplines, that try to teach us how the pyramids were built, and they demonstrate using the most simplest of tools, but they never describe the most difficult aspects of the work, nor do they replicate the most difficult aspects of the work. So it was my intention to present to the reader the evidence that needs to be explained before we can say, okay, I know now how advanced the ancient Egyptians were. And it is stunning when you look at the full scope of the work, and particularly the statues. The statuary is simply amazing. And there is a YouTube video. It's on my website. I think it's on Coast to Coast from the page now.
Yeah.
And essentially, that little video is a little clip, shows the symmetry of the Ramses bust at Luxor. And to collect those images, I actually traveled to Egypt three times because I needed to get a digital photograph of the highest quality, but one that was dead center to the center line of the head of Ramses, because I wanted to test it for symmetry. In other words, check one side of the face to the other. Again, remembering the time when I was at Memphis and looking down the Ramses statue and noticing the nostrils being identical, I detected that not just the nostrils, the entire nose, the jawline, and the eyes were perfectly symmetrical one side to the other. Now, what does that mean in a manufacturing terms? Well, for precision, to demonstrate something is perfect,
right?
Yes, you have to have a measurement. You have to be able to measure it with a standard. And in the case of the Ramses statue, the standard by which we measure the accuracy is one side of the face. And so we measure the other side of the face against the opposite. And when we have a condition where both sides of the face are perfectly the same, then we know that we have something that was intentionally crafted with extreme precision. And that's what that little video demonstrated. It also shows that they had a system of measure. They must have had some kind of geometric scheme, a protocol that they were using in order to transfer information from the designers to the craftspeople to the theorized machines that were necessary to actually control the tool as it cut the statue. And this geometry is amazing in and of itself, in that it incorporates the 3-4-5 triangle. Though the 3-4-5 triangle was first described by Pythagoras, it was known by the Egyptians, and they encoded it in the Ramses statue.
Well, the knowledge is incredible. Last week, I walked through one of these large hardware stores, and, you know, you see drills, screwdrivers, saws, and all these forms of equipment, all these kinds of things that are used to do things. Mm-hmm. And just to marvel at lost technologies of ancient Egypt for a moment, Christopher, what kind of tools did they have? They had to have them.
Oh yeah, well obviously they had them all right. One of the things that I did during my research for the book, I contacted a sculptor because I wanted to get the opinion of a modern sculptor to see, what they thought about the ancient Egyptians' work and what it would take them to actually make it, and whether they could make it with the tools that are known to have been in the ancient Egyptian toolbox, or that we accept were conventionally that were in their toolbox. And so I contacted Mike Leckie, who has is a very, very talented sculptor, and you can actually see some of his work at mikeleckie.com. But Mike Leckie returned with a letter to me, and he said that he would have to upgrade all his tools, and he's using, steel carbide chisels, and he'd have to go to diamond, and even then he won't be able to do it. He said he doesn't have enough time in his life to actually accomplish that kind of work, because he works in alabaster and marble, and the ancient Egyptians were plowing through granite with comparative ease. So I take a modern sculptor's view, but also I have my own point of view, which is that of a manufacturing engineer and ex-toolmaker and machinist. And, the cutting tools that we use for granite would be diamond tools. They cut very slow. There's also a method that you could use, such as impact machining, but you'd have to use, that's where the tool would peck at it at a very rapid rate, like an ultrasonic kind of machining.
Something like a dentist uses sometimes too. Right?
Yeah, only on a much larger scale. You're absolutely right. And NASA developed that one drill that they took to Mars to cut into hard rock, and that was an ultrasonic drill. But essentially, it just eats into a hard material like it's butter. So something like that we could design and use today. Of course, most Egyptologists would choke on the idea that the ancient Egyptians may have had that kind of technology. And so that's where the idea comes in, that maybe we have to go further back, and maybe these artifacts were misassigned or, incorrectly assigned to the ancient Egyptians and were created by an earlier culture.
When you think of tools, you then have to think of, because we're thinking beyond hammers and chisels, we're thinking of high sophisticated tools, then you have to think of a power source for the tools.
Exactly.
What could that have been?
The power source for the tools, and this is where the Giza power plant comes in. Not necessarily to say that the Giza power plant built itself, because it was the power source for the tools to cut the stone, to cut the power plant. It's like, what came first, the chicken or the egg? But because it demonstrates that the ancient Egyptians had a sophisticated knowledge of science and technology, and that they had developed a knowledge of electricity. They used it and were able to generate it. Of course, there's always the arguments, well, okay, if that's the case, where are the wires? Where are the Black and Decker drills? We don't find any out there in the desert. So, obviously the theory can't be right. But, again, we have to say, if we go far back in time, maybe we look for an extinction event, which would be 10,000 plus years ago. Then we can say over an extended period of time, a lot of the materials that this advanced civilization had developed and were using would have been adopted, machines would have been cannibalized, artifacts would have been put to different purposes, just for survival. And then eventually over time, they would have rotted away. An old Chevy in a ravine, an Indiana ravine that's been there for 20 years, and you know in a few hundred years that thing is not going to be up to much. So everything goes back to the earth eventually.
Fantastic. I mean, it's almost as if they picked them up, the tools, took them with them somewhere, buried them. Who knows?
Well, I kind of hope they did, George, because eventually, if they did bury them and they survived, then maybe eventually somebody would find them.
Yes.
And then the whole debate would be over. Here they are. But now, what the debate is centered on is if you believe, or anybody that comes forward and says they know how these artifacts were made, then they have to prove it. And if they think that the tools that are in the ancient Egyptian toolbox are capable of doing it, then they're absolutely wrong, because to date they haven't been able to demonstrate that.
Can any of these artifacts have been grinded out by hand at all to the perfection that they are?
In my history, there has been a lot of handwork. I mean, during an apprenticeship that I served in England as a young lad, we were taught the old-fashioned way on how to make things, and a lot of things that we made were by hand with precision. But associated with making things by hand with precision are the gauges to actually inspect the artifact that we're making, and to make sure that we are making it to the drawing, which includes particular tolerances or dimensions within a certain precision or accuracy. So even though things can be made by hand, there also has to be precision instruments to inspect it. Now, drilling a hole in granite, there are holes that we look at in granite in Egypt that you look at it and you say you couldn't do that by hand, because the tooling marks on the granite prove that they were using some kind of a tube or a drill that was drilling through the granite at a high feed rate. Similarly, if you go to Abu Rawash and you look at a granite stone at Abu Rawash, you see that they were cutting these stones with a very, very large diameter saws. And the Abu Rawash stone that I describe in Lost Technologies, and which I actually have an abbreviated version on my website at gizapower.com, under the article section, is called Lost Technologies of Ancient Egypt Adaptation, where your listeners can go read that article and look at some of the photographs. This particular stone has a radius cut in it along a particular the length of it or the face of it, but that radius ends in another radius. So what you have is what they call a compound radius, which is created when a saw is a circular saw is at an angle to the face of one of the radii, or both of the radii. So the evidence on that stone and measuring the radius, which I was able to do by calculating, by measuring the chord length and the sadiga height, or the chord height, the evidence shows that the saw that cut that particular piece was over 37 feet in diameter.
Oh, my gosh.
And that is incredible. Now, I mean, wrapping my mind around that notion, or that idea, was quite lengthy. How did they do it? I mean, it's just unbelievable. It's incredible information.
Let's get into some of these various statues when we come back.